Alright, good afternoon. This one being the last week in both the molecule and the control program, this would be in principle really the time to say what the future is going to bring, right? Unfortunately, my abilities to predict the future are probably rather below average, so I keep that both time-wise and content-wise in a very narrow scope.
So the future is quantum.
Well, okay, yes, I second that. Okay, so but anyway, I've started writing. I'm probably the worst person to give a Blackboard talk because I have a horrible handwriting. So please, tell me. You don't know how much I labored about that. So I started with next generation ultra cold, and of course the parentheses were meant to be here. So this is actually, please forgive me, especially those of you who know better than I. This is a very, very, very coarse grain idea of how the timelines go, okay? So I divided what is going on in the ultra cold molecules in first generation, next generation. And the first generation is definitely still very much going on, and much of the next generation is already going on. And of course, much more than that, too. So, I personally see the kind of beginning of this big wave of cold, ultra-cold molecule physics about in 2005. And I know there was a lot before, but this is when everybody kind of jumped on. So the first generation were basically dominated by two topics. The ones to first even get these molecules and get them cold and ultra-cold, that was really definitely the challenge of the day. This was basically both on the experimental and theoretical side, but on the experimental side pretty much exclusively. I would say we are kind of safely about in the Millikelvin range with the cooling by now. I mean, that varies by method, et cetera, but this is roughly. We are not quite there where the ultra-cold atoms are yet, but approaching. And on the theoretical side, was the kind of opening up of the field that these polar molecules have dipoles, right? So it's all kinds of stuff that you can do with them. First of all, dipoles, of course, have dipole-dipole interaction. So suddenly we have some particles that have an interaction. And of course, I mean, for quantum computing and all the quantum gates, this is great. So everybody was thinking about how to make quantum gates with dipole-dipole interaction. That was the one thing. So this was the dipole-dipole interaction. And the second big approach to using dipoles was looking at quantum simulation, many-body type phase diagrams, which are anisotropic due to the dipoles. So this was, let me just call this quantum phases. Yeah. Actually, this is quantum phases and quantum gates. So this was basically the first years, was much dominated by these two fields. What is going on now and what is kind of developing now, and what also for me somewhat comes out of this workshop in terms of next generation, are the questions that are asked now. So what are people looking at now? So the first thing is ultra-cold chemistry, which is very controlled, low number of channels, potentially low dimensions. What did I forget? A lot. I know I forgot a lot, but this is basically what ultra-cold chemistry is about, and the idea is really to have a coherent control over chemical reactions. And this is, please, in no particular order, okay? So the next is fundamental measurements, and they perhaps should be up here already. For example, the measurement or trying to set a limit to the EDM, the electronic electric dipole moment, which if it's non-zero would be a measure of CP violation. And the point is that in polar molecule internally, this is this effect is much increased, and therefore polar molecule give a very nice platform to potentially measure the EDM. There are a couple of experiments out there, and some of them were even appearing in the conference last week, 2 weeks ago. However, I should say, so far to my knowledge, nobody has measured an EDM yet, even in the molecule. So there are others, but the EDM is probably right now the most prominent kind of measurement of fundamental constant type. So of course the quantum information science also has developed somewhat. First of all, actually the quantum gates, not many people do that anymore. Okay, so it has really much shifted to the quantum simulation branch of quantum of the quantum information processing. One should say that the first molecules are now in optical lattices in the Jiller lab. So this is an experimental achievement of the last months, I should say. On both the theoretical and experimental side, people are looking into, in the beginning it was just, oh, assume we have a dipole, what kind of quantum phases can we get? By now, people are much more kind of conscious about what the experimental achievable geometries are, what the experimentally achievable parameters are, and potentially that the kind of lattice with single filling is perhaps not so easy, and what can we do with a less than perfect setup, etc. And the third part I want to mention here is that while in the beginning it was just dipole-dipole interaction, great, the dipole-dipole interaction in principle is a non-resonant effect, and now this is going more to kind of resonances that include dipole-dipole interactions. And there's a last point, and this is the point that kind of leads me on, is that of course also all the cooling schemes now become considerably more sophisticated, and part of that is because people know more, but part of that is also the kind of unfortunate fact, which I think is more and more, people are more and more conscious of, is that for molecules there is no one-fits-all solution in the type for atom. So there are some, and actually I will go into some of that. I won't list this now. So let me tell you, let me go a little bit into depth on this one. Okay, so here I've plotted the molecule. Okay, just you don't think so? The chemists are laughing, right? So why are the chemists laughing? Because I included way too few levels. Okay, this is so in my molecule. So to the right side we have the internuclear distance, and in the y-axis we have the energy levels. Of course, no molecule has only two electronic states, right? So this is the bare minimum which I showed there. Also, the number of vibrational levels that I put in here is a little bit exaggerated to the low side. But I mean, there's a limit to how much I can plot on the blackboard. I guess you get the idea. Oh, actually, I need my next piece of paper. So, what is the problem with cooling molecules? So the first is that molecules, if we want to cool molecules, they have to be cooled internally and externally. So this is something which a problem that in atoms just doesn't exist, because atoms are internally in their ground state at already at room temperature pretty much all of the time. So if you talk about cooling atoms, you always talk about external emotional cooling. For molecules, we first have to get them all the way down there. And this is much harder than it looks. So let me just give you an example, okay? Let's assume we start out with the electron sitting on this highest vibrational state of the ground electronic state. This is it's a very relevant example, because that's how they are often produced, either with photoassociation or Feshbach resonances. I'm not going into that. So just believe me here. And how do we get this electron down here? There are basically two viable approaches to this. The one is the one that is actually experimentally done. This is just a coherent transfer from here to here, for example, via stirrup. Okay, so you would excite it up here, and then you would stimulate it down here again. This works pretty nicely. The densities that you get are not that high, but it works nicely. The point is, this is a transfer and not really a cooling, because we don't do anything to the entropy in this case. Okay, so if we would really want to do cooling, we would have to let this decay. So the question is, why don't we just let it decay? So that problem is that these vibrational states, and I plotted a few of them, usually there are tens or even more of them, and the lifetimes of each single one of these is at least of the order of seconds. Okay, so if you would want to do this, it seems like you need a lot of time and a very good trap. So this is obviously not a particularly good idea. Okay, so let me just write this down. So the first one would be the internal cooling. Second one would be the external cooling. So the first one, the problem is why we cannot just do that the very simple straightforward line. The way is that the decay along the vibrational states is very slow. Oops. There we have. Supposed to be a gamma. Is at least of the order of seconds. And so now let's assume we have this, okay? Can be done somehow. Now the question is, what is the problem with the external cooling? So the typical way how we do external cooling in atoms is laser cooling. I don't think there are many people here who don't know how laser cooling goes, but let me repeat this anyway, briefly. So imagine you have your particles somehow running around in space and all moving very fast. And what you do, you shine in a laser light, let's say from this direction, which is somewhat red detuned to the, I talk about atoms, okay, I call molecules, red detuned to the atomic transition. So that means that only the atoms that move towards the laser are Doppler shifted in a way that they can be resonantly excited by this laser light. So we have them excited, and during this excitation, the atom has got a momentum kick in this direction, so it's cooled from its movement. And then it decays again, but the decay goes into 4 pi, so it doesn't add any kind of directionality anymore. And if we now put the laser from all directions, we can cool the atoms moving in all directions, right? This is very nice. However, these photomomentum kicks, they are very small. So we need like 10 to the 4 to 10 to the 5 of them in order to really get these particles cold. And in order to do that, they have to, when they decay, they always have to decay back into the same state they started with, so that we have a cycling transition, otherwise this doesn't work. And this is where the problem comes in. This is why you cannot do that with molecules, because if you do that with molecules, you somehow excite it some way up here, they will, in nearly all cases, decay into all of those levels here. And to get them kind of excited back from there is kind of, it's a daunting task. There are exceptions. Laser cooling has been done, but this is really the particular case where we can discount basically all but two or three of these vibrational states. Okay, so what is left to us? There's a lot left, but I want to talk about laser cooling. So the question is, please, I'm not complete here anymore. I'm just giving you two examples, okay, just to make this clear. So what if I just take my vibrational states and just look basically only at the lowest vibrational transition here? And here, I should be able to make a cyclic transition, because if I excite up here, there's nowhere to go than this lowest here, okay? Of course, the problem here with the very long lifetime still remains. All right, so what do we need to do? We need to speed this up, right? So that's the question. So there have been a couple of suggestions of how this can be done. For example, by Hans-Peter Büchler and the group around Guido Popeo. And this is actually probably a more relevant one for the quantum control people, because it uses some kind of engineered reservoir theory. So the idea is here that you really connect this vibrational transition coherently to a transition that's much faster. In that case, it involves Adams-Rydberg transitions, and then connect it back. That's not what I'm going to talk about. What I'm going to talk about is superradiance. So this is basically the second option. So one option is to do a reservoir engineering. And the second is to look at superradiance. Very good. So, this is done, I'm sorry. I should know my own stuff. Okay, so, here's my claim. Namely, that superradiance basically plays a role in most, or at least many, experiments that involve vibrational states and polar molecules in any way. And I will go into what I mean by superradiance in a second. Relevant for, I say many, I'm careful. I would say most, but for many, so also called polar molecule experiments. That involve vibrational transition at all. All right, so let me just give you a little bit a kind of general outline about superradiance. All right, So, what is superradiance? So the easiest way to imagine that is to see that as a coherent build-up of dipoles. So imagine you have two radiators, like two atoms, two two-level atoms or something like that, close enough together, so that if one emits a photon spontaneously, the second one is close enough that it can feel the first one's phase and therefore is emits in a stimulated way by the first. And then, of course, if you have a third, it gets stimulated by the two first, etc. So in a sense, it's like a feedback, like lasing. Feedback, less lasing. So what we have is we have a coherent build-up. So the first thing, sorry. So what is it? It's a coherent build-up. Build-up of a collective dipole. Collective dipole. Which is proportional to the number of particles. And therefore, because it's coherent, the decay rate is proportional to n squared. And if that happens, then it's called superradiance. Yes?
Sorry, does superradiance lead to loss of entropy?
It does. It is actually, this is a very good question, okay? Let me tell you a little bit more about superradiance in general to try to answer this. So superradiance is primarily, despite of this coherent build-up, a very incoherent process, okay? But it has, of course, both elements. It's just it turns out that the incoherent element is by far outweighs the other. There are some kind of coherent elements in basically all aspects. For example, if you have really, really strong superradiant decay, this decay will be directional. Not quite as nice in one line as a laser in most cases, but in principle. The point is that you need crazy strong superradiance to have it really directional. Otherwise, it's just a little bit directional, okay? But not enough to really keep it coherent. So yes, you do have. You do have basically similar entropy effect as this normal spontaneous emission. But this is, I mean, if one would have really very strong superradiance, that's definitely something that one has to see how much of that gets lost. Okay. So the point is, this effect is now about 60 years old, was first discussed by Dicke. And of course, there are now 60 years worth of calculation in between then and now. So the question is, why am I even talking about this? Okay. So the point is what has been done mostly, and especially early on, are basically all the easy cases that you can calculate. Either if you can stay in the so-called Dicke states, which are the completely symmetric states, which brings down the number of total relevant states from 2 to the n to just n plus 1. Or some cases where you have very small samples or very low dimensional kind of regular geometry, so something like that, something which considerably decreases the Hilbert space. The point is that a normal kind of traditional mean field approximation in that case doesn't work because it throws out all the important effects, so you won't even see superradiance. You can do a certain classical calculation which catches some of the physics, and a lot has been done and so I don't want to kind of claim too much, but anyway, so what we have done, we have tried to do a type of mean field that includes all the second order effects and still can really treat three-dimensional big homogeneous samples. That is the idea. So I will give you a one blackboard outline of how we do this. So, and the point is, sorry, what I really wanted to say is, if you do the full treatment, and what you have is a highly nonlinear many-body treatment, which usually cannot be calculated. So you do have to make some approximations. All right, so let's start with the full dynamics. At least in a formal way. This would mean we just have the total Hamiltonian consists of the Hamiltonian of the particles, the Hamiltonian of the field, and then the interaction of the two. So we have no other type of collisions or so others, anything else than photon-mediated collisions. So here we have the sum over all the particles. This is the particle dipole, and this is the full field. And the full field, of course, in principle has also all the modes, but right now they are still kind of assumed to be in there. So now the first thing which we do is we just assume we have, of course, we have an ensemble of particles here. We just randomly select two. Let's take these two. So we have basically two what we call probe atoms. Sorry, I'm already talking about atoms again, but I probably will just stick with this. We go to molecules afterwards. Two probe atoms, and all the others are basically, they're just giving the environment. If we do this, then we can we redefine our interaction Hamiltonian to include only our two probe atoms. Now, this is what we call V. This is the interaction Hamiltonian. And all the effect of all the other atoms, we now pack into this one already, so that we basically get a Heisenberg operator here. Okay, so far there's no approximation. Okay, this is it's just a kind of a redefinition what is what. Okay, so the interaction of the probe atoms with everything else is here. The interaction between everything else is all in here. Okay, so and then what we have now just a formulation where we have two particles in the field. And in this particular case, the one way to formulate that is if we write that as an evolution operator, which is often it's called U if you write a state, and S if you write a density matrix. So this one would be the exponent of minus I over H bar, and then we have an integral over the time, and then we have this interaction time, right? So of course this of now only works if we do the proper time ordering. Otherwise this just gives us the wrong result. And since we are in a density matrix formulation, the time ordering has to be done along a Kaldish contour. And I'm not going to go into this Kaldish contour, but the idea is that you have for basically the cat part of your density matrix, you have time ordering, and for the bra part, you have an anti-time ordering. And this is all basically connected into this Kaldish contour. And the integration then also has to go along this contour, all the way from minus infinity to plus infinity and back. And the time ordering is done along this contour. So everything which is on the lower part of the branch is ordered always to the right side of what comes in the upper part of the branch, for example. So far, still, this is just a reformulation. This is still has all the degrees of freedom and cannot be calculated, okay? I've not done any approximation so far or anything like this. That comes now. So this is only a kind of a clever way how to formulate that. And why do I want to do that? Because now I make a series evolution, and the series evolution is a cumulant expansion, which is very nice, because for a cumulant expansion, the expectation value of the exponent is the exponent of the exponent of the cumulants. So let's just write this down. So I just call this whole operator which I have on the top x, and then I make an expectation value of that. And this can be written as s is a some kind of complex numbers. So it's e to the sum of s to the n divided by n factorial, and s now, if one does it exact, goes from 0 to infinity, times the so-called cumulant of x to the n. And this is very nice. Why? Because what we want to do, we want to find the expectation value of this of this whole expression here, right? And if we formalize it like that, we can basically, the fact that we now have a differential equation involving this expectation, this exponent here, we still have a differential equation involving an exponent, which is always nice because it's just easier to calculate the derivatives, etc., if you have an exponent. Okay? So far, there's still no approximation, but now the approximation comes, namely that we just say we, instead of to infinity, we just go to 2. Okay? It looks pretty brutal, I know, but the point is that this cumulant expansion takes all direct particle-particle interactions, also the indirect ones, into account. Okay? So it's actually, it turns out, it's a pretty powerful approximation.
And
this is just some, I'm sorry, this is, this Sx is now basically this whole expression. So S is just some kind of C number.
The sum's over n, of course.
The sum is over, yeah. This. Oh, I'm sorry, yeah. That's right. I apologize. So this is just that you could probably do it without that, and then you would have everything in here, but this is just so if you now make this approximation, and this is a pretty brutal approximation, but it's also one that really now gets rid of a lot of the degrees of freedom in this problem. So, and then of course I didn't say what these expectation values are. So what we are doing, and here now you can do in principle what you want. Since we are in principle interested in the particle or atom dynamics in that case, this expectation value is a trace over the field degrees of freedom. Okay, so what you get at the end, you get all this, actually it turns out that for super radians, the first order is completely irrelevant. It basically gives you local field effects. Okay, they are so weak, just forget it. Okay, if you just leave them out, it's fine. The second order, however, are really strong. And the point is, these second order cumulants you now can calculate with standard Green's function techniques like Dyson equation or something like this. So, this one, this whole expectation value is over the field degrees of freedom. And so what are we left with? We have only two atoms, because all the atoms are already packed in the field degrees of freedom. And then we average over the field degrees of freedom. Of course, it has to be done self-consistently and somewhat sophisticated. But I mean, as I say, Dyson, for example, with the Dyson equation, found a very nice way to deal with this. And what we now have is just the two-atom master equation. And this is now very tractable. It's still very, it's very nonlinear, but it can be. I mean, my laptop is definitely able to solve, at least if we have two-level atoms, to solve this and kind of compare what comes out with experimental results. All right, so now what comes out of this equation?
This would be a good approximation.
Good question. So you are asking why don't we keep the higher orders?
Well, it seems like a rather drastic.
So, so the point is, first of all, this now really kind of gets rid of only the really, as I say, indirect particle-particle correlations are still in there. It's just true, for example, three body forces or something like that, which are out. But for example, if we would kind of go to something like FMR or so, this would still be all in there. The point is, I can tell you, it's just that comparison with experiment seems to suggest that the thing is described fairly well by that. Let me give you another reason. So if we would have a massive many-body entanglement in this system, that one would obviously get lost. Okay, so turns out, and this is completely unrelated to that, but we are actually also looking in a different project. Turns out that massive many-body entanglement in superradiance does not play a role. Okay. In fact, if you do, and this is rough. This is for we have shown that only for certain cases, etc. But for the clean Dicke type of case, there is no entanglement created by superradiance. Okay. So you're right. This is not the proof. It's just the kind of evidence seems to suggest that this is a very good explanation. All right.
You have a collective dipole, which I assume means all of the molecules are sort of lined up.
Yeah.
But then you only look at, you single out two from this.
Yeah, and then I basically, and then I can look at.
Well, I think of this as a correction, the first correction.
So to say, yeah, that's right.
In field theory, you single out one, and the others are in black. Right. That's not enough here.
Yeah.
Well, this is the next.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's actually, it's a good point. Let me say, we did the next correction, so the next generation does the third order correction. Okay. It's a point. I'm not saying this gives 100% all the physics. Okay, for some of the physics, you definitely, this is not the right treatment. The point is that it really seems to kind of reproduce experiments very well. So apparently, it's not completely wrong. But yeah, if somebody wants to do some serious analytic problems, that is third order. This is quite a bit of a calculation. Okay, so one of the things that was, perhaps it wasn't a question since a long time. For me, it was a question since a long time when I started this. What, is there any way to take one single parameter to tell me whether we can expect superradiance somewhere or not? Okay. This seems to be, in the meantime, what comes out of our calculation, and what seems, I know at least two other groups who have come up with the same parameter, is that this one parameter would be the optical depth. And while this is somewhat intuitive, that it's something that involves the density and the wavelengths and perhaps the system size, I don't know an intuitive proof why this should be like that. It just comes out here and comes out pretty clearly. And at least one of the other groups is also, they do, actually not even analytical, they just do a numerical simulation. It also just comes out. Okay, so if somebody knows a really kind of clear, easy proof why the optical depth should be the parameter in this case, I would be really interested to learn it. So. So this is the optical depth, which has to be large. And it turns out large, it's a smooth transition, okay? But large is about 10 to the 3 and higher.
What are the units?
Oh, optical depth is a unitless quantity, but let me write it down. So optical depth is density times wavelength squared times system size. Okay? So
it can be possibly a single parameter, right? Because like the wall is optically dense, right? But it's not, doesn't super ID. Right?
Well, it's right. There are actually many more parameters, of course, right? I think the wall would be certainly super radiating. It's just that we don't see it because everything gets absorbed before we can measure something.
Probably a smooth radiatively broadened system. This is the problem.
Up to a point, yes. It doesn't have, but this is a good point. It has to be somewhat radiatively broadened. If you have massive decoherence in there, like for example Doppler broadening, that doesn't kill superradiance, but it diminishes it somehow. We have once done a calculation where we have kind of assumed a visible transition with superradiance with typical Doppler broadening of something like of the order of 10 to the 3 line widths or something like that. You still would see superradiance, but it's much weaker. But yeah, you have of course a good point here. So now let's go back to my claim. Okay, why do I dare to say such a thing? So if you look at typical, for example, bialkali molecules and the typical experiments that people do, in this case, I have my table here. So typical. Bialkali samples. For these, we assume a density of about 10 to the 9. We have this. Actually, we have for this particular thing, we have 5 times 10 to the 9. So let's just put that per cubic centimeter, and a sample size of about 100 micrometer. Which I think for most of the experiments is not very far away. Okay. In fact, the first experiment that we have compared that with was actually a factor of 10 bigger. Never mind. Okay, so in this case, the typical optical densities are somewhere of the order of 10 to the 3 to 10 to the 5. So at the lower end would be, for example, lithium cesium, you barely see superradiance. At the upper end, superradiance effects are already pretty massive. Okay? So, and with the last, I don't know, 5 minutes or so, I give you two of those experimental examples. The wavelengths are usually typically of the order of I have this here. I don't want to say something wrong. It's of a couple of gigahertz, perhaps tens of gigahertz, something of that. Terahertz. Actually, perhaps terahertz is closer. So lithium cesium, I think, has 5.5 terahertz. This has a very wide vibrational spacing, so it's somewhere below there. The first example actually is not even molecules. The first example were Rydberg atoms. So the story is the following. My colleagues at UConn, they had one of the first ultra-cold Rydberg atom experiments. And they had these nice rubidium Rydberg atoms somewhere at n equal to 40. And this was also about these parameters here, okay? With a wavelength of about 1 terahertz. And they had them up there, and they are also supposed to live for a while, at least a couple of hundreds of milliseconds, and they just decayed way too fast. And they just didn't know. They thought, ah, perhaps they got irradiation or so, but it just all really didn't really account for that incredible speed up of about a factor of 100 that they got. So they came to me and said, yeah, we've heard you do, this was when I was still fairly new in Connecticut, we've heard you do super radiance, can you do an estimate for us? And so we did an estimate for them, and whether super radiance could actually be the culprit for this fast decay. For this, actually, the first interesting question was, how does a Rydberg atom decay? So just as a short aside, of course, if we have n equal to 40, there are basically two options or two kind of extremes. The one is the n equal 40 decays via fairly short wavelengths directly in n equals 6 or n equal 5. Okay? So this would be 40 into 6. Or it decays into 39 and then 38 and 37, etc. If you do the numbers, here, let's just here do the decay times, basically inverse Einstein A coefficient. What you would get in a case like this is something of the order somewhere between, if we have a millisecond here and 100 microsecond here, it's somewhere in between here, it's about here for rubidium. Okay? If you, however, then look for a vacuum decay, How this develops, it's going, the curve is going, something like that, okay? So in vacuum, this is about 2 to 3 orders of magnitude more likely than this. However, if you now look at the dense sample, which has whatever kind of speed up we get here, whether you call it super radiance or merely amplified spontaneous emission or so, it doesn't even make a difference in this particular case. If you look at that, this curve down here for the short wavelengths, it's not very strong because for that, this parameter is still fairly small, right? So here we start at the same point, but then it dramatically differs. It goes about like this, okay? So the point is, and this is the density that they had for this. This curve is for this kind of density. So the point is that, so this is vacuum, and this is dense. So that means that in these densities, this is vastly, 3 to 4 orders more likely than the decay in the short wavelengths, okay? These long wavelengths, however, give a very high optical depth, namely something like 10 to the 5 or so. And so super radiance is very likely. So what we did, I had a student who was very good, but also was not averse to do a lot of work. So what he did, he basically added up all the possible channels that this can decay to, and just made a plot and compared that with the experimental plot, and it turns out this is basically on top of it. Yeah.
Question. I mean, n is here the number of excited Rydberg states or the number of ground state atoms?
That's the number of excited Rydberg states.
So they don't have a lot of blockade phenomena in this experiment?
No. No. This is a very broad. And they had, they had like 1,000, 1,500 particles or so, okay? And this is not a very high density, right? So, they didn't. So, here, what comes out was, it could still have been something else. We don't have a proof, but it looks very, very likely that super radiance is the explanation here. And the other one, and I don't even want to say much about this, was that we discussed with Matthias Weidemüller, who had a lithium-cesium experiment and did exactly what I told you before that nobody does. Namely, he put that in the uppermost vibrational level and just waited that this decays down. And then he measured this. And again, the same phenomenon, it was just decaying too fast. In this case, the speed up was somewhere factor of 2 to factor of 10. It wasn't as dramatic as for the Rydbergs. But again, so what we did, we basically did the same calculation again, looked at the curves, experimental curve versus theoretical curve, etc., and again found that super radiance, other than black body radiation and some other effects, actually really exactly recovers the experimental curve.
The dipole moment between higher vibrational state can be very weak or not. So how does it depend on the dipole?
It's a good point. There's of course a lot of details to that. So the point is that the only measurement curves that Matthias had were from the lowest, I think, 10 or so vibrational states. Okay, what we have done, we actually have used the real transition elements here, okay, to kind of fit these data. But we took them only from the lower ones because that's basically the only data that we had available. So, this one, the coincidence that we got here is probably somehow more striking than the ones that we got for lithium cesium, I should say. Okay, so at the end, I just want to leave you with two questions. which go back to what I said before, one and a half questions. So the question is, now, can it be used for laser cooling? So again, let's just take these lowest two vibrational states and let's see whether we can speed this up, and then pumping it directly is not very convenient, but one can do some kind of Raman scheme to pump this. So I should say, unfortunately, I mean, even while one can get quite some speed up here, if that is of the order of seconds, the natural decay, even if we get a speed up of, let's say, up to 5 orders of magnitude, which would be really a lot, it's still too slow to really think about laser cooling because we would have a lot of those. But it's still a kind of an interesting question. Does it in principle work that the super radiance basically cools into the same channels as the spontaneous emission? And we are still working on that. So far, evidence seems to say yes, but the final answer is out. So this is the one. And the other one, other question is, can one actually use this to do better spectroscopy? And I cannot say anything. Okay, thank you.
Question. Now, in a molecule, you have, of course, emission in a certain direction, so to speak.
Always.
Does this play a role for the super radiance? If you have now your molecule somehow oriented or not oriented, the sugar?
Yes. Oh, yeah, absolutely. But what was done for this calculation, again, I mean, there's a couple of really rough approximations in there. So what we have assumed here is an average over all possible polarizations. On the other hand, this is always the one where I kind of blush because it's in my eyes the worst approximation. All of that is fine, okay? The worst approximation is that at least the simple calculation is assumes a single mode, which is not as bad as it sounds because many of those samples happen to be geometrically such that the Fresnel number is about 1. So a single mode approximation is not too bad. But in principle, you would have to kind of divide whatever particles are available on the different kind of available modes. So if you have a lot of modes, this will not give a good approximation.
You claim superradiance plays a role for vibration states. Now, doesn't it get much worse if you look at rotation states?
Yes, I would think so, yeah.
So actually, the experiments also for rotation states, one has to be careful about.
Yeah, I would definitely say so. I didn't want to complicate this, but yes, what I said is even more true for rotational states, yes. Only that the rotational decays usually are even slower, right? In their case, I mean, even the speed up due to super radiance might still be kind of days or months or something like this. But.
Maybe I'll ask a question which sort of takes advantage of multidisciplinary kind of audience here. So I was kind of wondering whether these effects, like superradiance type effects, might have played a role, for example, in cooling of the universe. And whether, for example, these inhomogeneities, which are sort of, you know, people are talking about, I don't know nothing about it, you know, whether perhaps they could be explained as some kind of burst of emission associated with these things. Okay, I don't know if it's a question,
No, I don't think so.
I mean, the point is you would really need exactly, I don't know if there is there a good understanding of exactly what the spectra
Should have been talking about some non-equilibrium.
Because the spectrum is, of course, getting quite different if you have super radiance. But I mean,
but I'm lasers, but I never heard about super radiance. But I'm real lasers, which are produced by.
But then, of course, it probably, in a, at least in the universe, the two things, they are not so different.
Exactly. Right? So it's lasers.
So at the time, was a background decouple, it was hydrogen going neutral. Was a transition, so there was no.
He's talking about the inflation, the end of inflation.
The end of inflation. Okay, but you want to get the spectrum of the fluctuations.
Yeah. Different problem. They're very weak.
But potentially, this, you know, the optical density in the universe can be achieved gigantic. I mean, that's a totally, I mean, it's related to this, you know, lasers and stuff like this, you know.
There's, of course, also one thing which I mean, I left a lot of stuff out. One of the things that I left out is that, of course, if you look into super radiance, it's massively time dependent, right? If you throw it, unless you are driving it constantly, which things change. But if you have an initially inverted system, for example, and this decays down, this, of course, a time dependent problem, right? And this really n squared speed up is only a fairly short sliver of time. It's the most important one, but still.
Pedestrian kind of sounds similar.
Any other questions? Thanks, Susan.
Okay, thank you.